The U.S. Supreme Court today issued two rulings that are very important both to Wisconsin politics and potentially American politics. First, the U.S. Supreme Court decided to hear the challenge to the legislative district lines drawn by Republicans after the 2010 census, ruling one. Ruling two, on a 5-4 vote, the U.S. Supreme Court stayed a lower court order that told Republicans to redraw those lines by November 1 of this year. To discuss all this, a political science and law professor, Ryan Owens. Professor Owens, welcome to Wisconsin Eye.
Thanks.
I'm quoting here from the New York Times, this case could reshape American politics. The Washington Post said it's a landmark case. Are they overstating it?
Well, it depends what happens with the case. I think if it goes the direction I think is going to go, it will be landmark, but potentially not for the same reasons why the Washington Post and others thought it might be. So what the court did today is it decided to hear this case, but at the same time, it did impose a stay on the lower court's decision. And that's pretty significant because what it means is the district court's ruling in the case is basically put on hold. And it's significant for this reason, because the court doesn't often issue these stays. And when it does, it's a pretty strong signal that they disagreed with the lower court's decision.
Oh, well, that fascinates me. But let's back up.
Yep.
Now,
yep.
Let's talk about this, the maps drawn by Republicans after the 2010 census.
Sure.
They were in the courts once, and the courts tinkered with two assembly districts, just did some minor. So what was different about the nature of this challenge, which is now been accepted by the U.S. Supreme Court?
Right. Well, so a couple of things. The case was accepted by the U.S. Supreme Court, but it did something that we can get into in a little bit, is it granted it, but it said we're going to talk about the jurisdictional matters of the case once it comes to us.
Okay.
So it was a grant, but they still haven't said that they're going to decide it on the merits. They still may decide this just on the jurisdictional grounds. Okay, so we can hold off on that for a second. But the other thing that's sort of unique about this is that the litigants in the case were challenging this sort of on a statewide basis. They said, we don't want to just pick at this district or this district or this district. We want to say that the entire thing statewide was problematic. And that was a somewhat unique claim.
Yep.
And it's something that I think if the court does decide on the merits, it may wind up sort of looking at that particular issue.
Well, what intrigues me is this case introduces a concept of wasted votes.
Right.
And then if I'm reading the it gets to the inefficiency gap.
Yeah.
The difference between the two parties' wasted votes divided by the total number of votes cast yields an efficiency gap, The gap in Wisconsin was 13.3% in the 2012 elections, 9.6% in 2014.
Mm-hmm.
Those that brought the suit argue that the efficiency gap should be no more than 7%.
Right.
This is a new claim. So the Democrats, you've seen their statements, they're claiming victory that the court could set a national precedent,
right,
which is why the Times wrote this case could reshape American politics.
Yep.
Talk to me about the legal arguments here.
Well, so there's a number of different arguments here. I think the challenge is really brought on First Amendment grounds and on 14th Amendment grounds. Of course, the First Amendment is the free speech, free association, and the 14th Amendment is equal protection. Most of these kinds of claims are brought under the 14th Amendment equal protection.
Equal protection.
And I think to the extent that we're going to get much out of this case, that's where most of it will be focused. And so the claim here is that by jamming all kinds of Democrats into one district, right, you're loading them up. It's called packing. So you put a bunch of people in one particular district, well more than the 50% plus one that they would need in order to get that party elected.
Yes.
So you jam them all into this one district so that these other outlying districts remain somewhat more competitive than if, you know, the Democrats or the Republicans were in it.
Yep.
And so the claim there is that by jamming Democrats or by jamming Republicans into one district,
yes,
and making the other districts, you know, more competitive or maybe more friendly to the majority party in power, that you're treating those voters unequally from other voters.
Because you're wasting votes.
Exactly, because your vote in one area is meaningless versus somebody else's vote in a different area. Right, and I think most people are familiar with this, right? If you live in Massachusetts during a presidential election year, there's no way you're going to vote for a Republican, right? Your vote is almost meaningless at that point. And the same could be true for Democrats in Alabama. The difference here, of course, is that there are constitutional guidelines, state laws to be followed in terms of redistricting.
Now, this is a potential new argument because the U.S. Supreme Court has never been shy in voiding district lines, boundary lines, legislative districts for racial reasons. They recently did that in North Carolina.
Yes.
So there has been an accepted standard. The court has said, if you gerrymander, draw to hurt on a racial basis, we're going to throw it out.
Mm-hmm.
But now this is a unique argument.
It is unique, and there are a couple of things that are unique about this. One, political gerrymandering, so to speak, has been going on forever, right? As long as the country's been around, we've had it. It's different to the extent that this claim here challenges a statewide redistricting policy rather than district by district. And in these racial gerrymandering cases, you have to bring them on a district by district basis. So, you know, who was brought into the district and who was pushed out of the district. So that's very important. And it is, in fact, that's an issue that the state of Wisconsin has pointed out, that even in these racial gerrymandering cases, I mean, and this is the worst of the worst kind of stuff we're talking about here, even in those, you've got to proceed district by district. This threshold shouldn't be, you know, easier than that. Okay, so those things make this a little bit different. And the final thing is, and I'm sure we'll talk more about this, is the court has not come down clearly on the standard to be used in these political gerrymandering cases. It's gone back and forth, and there's a lot of discomfort among the justices on this issue.
Well, the issue here, correct me if I'm wrong, the issue here is the U.S. Supreme Court going to recognize a partisan gerrymandering standard, as it's already recognized racial.
Yeah.
Is that a fair summary?
Well, in 1986, the court actually did sort of recognize a partisan gerrymandering case. No, this was, I can't remember the name of it. Nope.
I'm sorry. So
this was earlier on in 86, and it was a plurality opinion written by Justice White. And basically they said that you can proceed with these partisan gerrymandering cases if you can show two things. If you can show an intent to discriminate and an effect to discriminate. And that goes beyond just having some votes washed out. It has to show that as a group you're effectively dismantled from voting for the party or the candidate that you want. Now, the problem is since 1986, the lower courts have had a very difficult time establishing how that test is applied. What's the benchmark you use? You know, what are the data to which you should look? And they had a real difficult time. So in, I believe it was 2004, the court hears another case, the VF case. And in that decision, it was another plurality decision. Four conservative justices in a judgment written by Justice Scalia said these partisan gerrymandering cases, non-justiciable. We're not going to deal with them.
It's a state-by-state issue, right?
Right. It's a political question.
Yes.
That we, as the federal courts, shouldn't get ourselves involved with because it's fraught with problems. Now, Justice Kennedy concurred in the judgment in that case, but what he said was essentially this: I'm very uncomfortable having the federal courts get involved in this area because it is fraught with so many potential pitfalls. But I'm not comfortable enough right now to say that we should foreclose all claims on those grounds. So everybody in this case is looking at Justice Kennedy. What will he do?
Was this case tailored to appeal to Justice Kennedy by arguing wasted votes and efficiency gap? Was this a blatant appeal to Justice Kennedy to bring him over to lead a 5-4?
Yeah, I mean, I think most of these cases these days are, right? You know, Kennedy is the swing voter, and particularly in this case, I mean, you know where Justice Thomas stands on this because he was in that plurality opinion with Scalia. I think you're reasonably, you have a reasonable estimation of where Alito is and probably the chief is on this one, likely Gorsuch. And we also know where the four liberals stand on this, given some of their previous decisions. So really, this is a case that, you know, Justice Kennedy is the one that we're looking at. And I think that his decision today to join that 5-4 to put a stay on the opinion is a strong signal.
Well, let me ask you this. Were you surprised that the U.S. Supreme Court took our case, with the Wisconsin case?
Not especially. I mean, I think it's a pretty important case.
Well, here's what Brad Schimmel told TMJ Radio this morning. If the Supreme Court adopted an efficiency gap, wasted vote standards, and I'm quoting the Attorney General, who will be interviewing this afternoon, one-third of state maps in America would fail. This is why more than 10 states run by Republican-elected elected officials filed amicus on this, right?
Right.
So the stakes are potentially huge.
Well, I think that's right. Yeah, and you know, that argument was one that was made in their brief as well as a reason for imposing the stay. Yeah, I mean, I think if the court winds up affirming the lower court's decision in the case, it would have tremendous implications. Now, of course, they didn't have to hear the case on the merits. They could have adopted a summary affirmance and just said, we're done with it. Right, they didn't
and
do that.
And let's stand the lower court ruling.
Exactly.
Or that would have overturn it.
Right, that would have they could have summarily reversed it or summarily affirmed it. They didn't do either, right? They could have decided not to impose a stay on it, but they did. So all of these things are pointing in the sign of undoing what the lower court did, okay? So if you're a Democrat right now in Wisconsin, you've got to be very concerned. If you're a Republican in Wisconsin right now and you supported this, I think you have to be very happy. The gray area here is that we don't know what Kennedy is thinking or what the rationale of the reversal might be. They may say, you got it wrong, this is a non-justiciable question. Or they could say, you got it wrong because you applied the wrong standard and here's the right one.
Well, that gets me to my next question. The Democrats, let me read from a statement from Assembly Democratic Leader Peter Barca. There could be a precedent set to end extreme partisan gerrymandering. Voters should be able to choose their representatives, not the other way around. And here's a statement from State Democratic Chair Martha Lanning. I am confident that the 2011 legislative maps will be declared unconstitutional. Compare that with Attorney General Schimmel, who told TMJ Radio, today's rulings, today's decisions by the U.S. Supreme Court, two pieces of good news. And Rick Essenberg of the Wisconsin Institute for Law of Liberty predicting that the court will not adapt to political gerrymandering. Brad Schimmel, Rick Essenberg, Peter Barker, Martha Lanning can't all be right. I mean, so
it's true.
But you think the Republicans have got the stronger hand here?
Well, I think if you just look at what the court has done and you compare that historically to what they've done, right? We know, first off, that more often than not, when the court agrees to take a case, they do it because they want to reverse. About 65% of all the cases they hear, they reverse. So already you know that, okay, we've got something there. Then we've got this signal that you know, they've imposed a stay. So you know, it could be that the court says, we are going to get involved with this political gerrymandering stuff, but we have to adopt a clear test. It's possible. And Justice Kennedy could do that here. But even if that's the case, you know, then the decision probably gets kicked back down to the lower courts. And it's unclear that anything could be worked out, you know, in terms of the next
is it possible elections. That Judge Kennedy, who obviously is the key vote here, said by joining with the majority, voiding the November 1 order, I don't want to put a gun to the head of Wisconsin legislators to redraw districts within a few months. I want to hear the arguments. So do you think Kennedy's voting to Wisconsin doesn't have to redraw? How significant is that?
Well,
could he have just been buying time?
He could have been buying time, and it's quite possible that he was. But if you look at the standards for granting a stay and the Supreme Court's rules, one of the factors to which you look is whether or not the litigant has a reasonable probability of success on the merits. And if the answer to that question is yes, you're more likely to get that stay. So by virtue of him voting to grant that stay, it does indicate that he at least believes at this point that Wisconsin has a reasonable likelihood of success on the merits.
And that's why the Attorney General calls it
bingo,
a piece of good news.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yep.
Talk to me about the timelines here. The court has said we're accepting it. When might we get a ruling? When might it be orally argued?
Right. I think we're likely looking at a November, maybe a December oral argument date. You know, this time of year when the court grants review to cases, right, you already have a few that are built up on the docket for the next term. Okay. So I think we're probably looking at November, December. In a case of this magnitude, I think they're going to spend some time to work on it. So it'll be one of these blockbuster cases, likely the beginning of the summer, probably end of May, beginning of June. Now, what the court could say is these claims are non-justiciable. Right, that's a pretty landmark decision. I mean, I think it's a landmark case as well.
If it does that, who wins?
Then Wisconsin wins, right? Because essentially, it voids what the lower court's decision was.
We are not accepting jurisdiction. We're letting stand the lower court ruling.
No, we're not even letting stand the lower court ruling.
Okay,
we're wiping it all out.
Thank you for that correction.
Yep.
One of the issues here is Attorney General Schimmel in his TMJ radio interview says, you know, Democrats choose to, his term, congregate in areas with heavy voter turnout.
Right.
So explain that argument to me, because you have the number of Democrats in the Wisconsin Assembly has dropped from 52 to 35. over the course of about 10 years. And Schimmel was saying, hey, we can't be penalized because Democrats choose to congregate in Milwaukee largely in Dane counties. Mm-hmm. Talk about that. I find that fascinating.
Well, it is. I mean, that's a trend that we've seen, you know, across the country as well, that, that Democrats tend to move to or live in urban areas. Republicans tend to live in suburban areas and rural areas. And so if you just sort of try to divide the state up equally, right, just put a grid on there, you'd get some pretty messed up districts because you'd have, you know, all Democrats here, all Republicans here. Mm-hmm. And so you have to weight this by population somewhat. But when you do that, you know, you're forced to target here and here and here and here. And if all the population is residing in or near Milwaukee, I mean, those districts are going to be very, very small, very compact. And the districts for Republicans are going to be very, very large and widespread. And that's a problem, right? Because one of the things you want to do when you redistrict is to try to maintain the integrity of existing political boundaries. You also try to maintain
communities of interest, isn't that?
Yeah, exactly. And incumbency status and that kind of thing, right? So if you're trying to keep communities together and you've got this concentration here, right, logically speaking, a concentration here would include an expansion here. But if you want to keep political communities together, not introduce significantly larger ones, you have this problem of one group here, everybody everywhere else. And so that makes it complicated.
Would the November 8 results in Wisconsin for the election for president make any difference? The fact that Kenosha County, which voted for Democratic presidential candidates for decades, mm-hmm. went for Trump. Mm-hmm. Would the fact that Trump carried Wisconsin for the first time since 84, would that have any bearing when it's argued before the Supremes?
Oh, it might. I mean, to the extent that that each side is going to try to say, you know, the position we've taken in the past is consistent with Democratic principles, of course. I think they're going to make that argument. And the Democrats will say things like, well, you got, you know, under a majority of the vote, but you've got a majority of the districts, or you know, a majority of the legislature. Republicans are going to say, look at the voting behavior of these particular areas. Mm-hmm. Things are changing. Mm-hmm. We're in power. One of the difficult things with these cases is sometimes it's hard to distinguish between a party that's doing well, right, or a party that's benefiting from its status as the gerrymandering party.
Right. In his TMJ interview, the Attorney General said you have varying, you have candidates with varying strengths, and they have various messages. Yeah. So the voters make the decision. So he's again coming back to two pieces of good news. Okay, let's assume it's argued by the end of November.
Yep.
When might we see a ruling?
I would think the beginning of the summer.
Beginning of the
end of spring, beginning of the summer.
What does that mean for the boundaries for the November 2018 elections? Stay in place, likely?
I would think so. I mean, the court seems to have been sensitive, with granting the stay, it seems to have been sort of sensitive to the timeliness issue. Mm-hmm. I would think maybe they'd hold off. But it's entirely up to the court. They can fashion whatever remedy they want in these cases.
What most surprised you about the court's two actions today?
I guess I was a bit surprised by the 5-4 stay, simply because I just wasn't sure that Kennedy would do that. He's difficult to pin down.
Yes.
And one of the things that occurred to me, and I've been trying to think about whether Kennedy is going to retire at the end of this term or not. Originally, I didn't think so. I thought he would stick around for another year. But then you hear the rumblings out of D.C. from people like Chuck Grassley and others saying that there's going to be a retirement. Well, you think to yourself, if there's a retirement at the end of this term, who is it likely to be?
Ginsburg from the liberal wing?
No, I think the only way Ginsburg leaves is if she's sort of involuntarily forced to get off the court. The only two people that I could see actually leaving voluntarily would be potentially Justice Thomas. Mm-hmm. I've heard that he doesn't find the work on the court as interesting as he used to. And if anybody was going to retire under President Trump, I would think he might be one who had the same kind of mindset. Or Kennedy. And what I've heard is that he may have to retire because of family reasons. I have no idea if that's the case or not. So if he does retire at the end of this term, and he's voted to grant review in this case.
Yes.
He's sort of leaving a stinker around for his colleagues, right? So we'll just have to see what happens there. I found that to be a little surprising with Kennedy. But, you can't tell with him sometimes.
You surprised that the newest justice, Mr. Gorsuch, joined the stay?
No, not at all.
Not at all?
No. I think he's in line with that, the sort of that Alito, Scalia, Thomas philosophy of, you know, this. We need to be very careful with how the court gets involved with these things. And so I'm not at all surprised that he decided we, you know, put a stay on this. He's likely to be one who writes an opinion. You know, if the court gets involved, he's likely to write a dissenting opinion saying we shouldn't be involved with this.
Okay. Yeah. We taxpayers get to pay for all the efforts by the Attorney General and the lawyers that are trying to uphold the boundaries drawn in 2011, correct?
Mm. Yes.
Yeah, we don't get taxpayers don't get billed for the attorneys that brought the suit that are challenging the boundaries?
No, I mean, not for the private litigants who are challenging it. I mean, we have to defend the state's interests, of course, and that, you know, those attorneys are salaried, and they're the ones doing that, yeah.
Who will be arguing on behalf of the state?
Oh, that's a good question. And now Paul Clement was hired for this, I believe, right?
Yes.
And if anybody is
he's
gonna,
a former Solicitor General.
He is a former Solicitor General. He is a Wisconsin native. If anybody is going to argue the case effectively, I think Paul Clement. He's pretty well known as the best oral advocate today, I think.
Heavy hitter.
He is a heavy hitter. Yep. Many cases.
You're a law professor. Would you like to argue this?
No, thank you.
No, thank you? Why?
Well, these are interesting claims. But, you know, in my position, you know, I'm an academic. I try not to get too far out and take positions on policy angles one way or the other. I enjoy the scholarly aspect of these. And one of the virtues of being an academic and a professor is you oftentimes feel more like a judge. You can sit and review of things and see who has the better of the arguments. And that's quite appealing.
Did you have a chance to read the briefs in this case?
I did. I read many of them, actually. I thought they were well briefed.
Okay.
Yeah.
With paid for by our tax dollars on behalf of the state, correct?
Yes. Okay. Well, so the state brief, right, filed by the Attorney General in Misha Tsetlin, the state SG.
Yes.
I read their brief. I read the Whitford brief. And a couple of the amici brief too, and they were well argued. I mean, I think one of the things that the court is going to enjoy is a well briefed case. That's clear.
Why should the average Wisconsin resident, who doesn't really understand reapportionment, they probably voted. Why should they care about this case?
Right. Well, I think there are two big picture questions here. The first involves sort of this fundamental notion of democracy and who represents whom. And the other is a big picture ticket item on institutional power and institutional prerogatives. Right? So the first issue is the one that we hear mostly about, and that is who's going to rule us. Right? It's really important that, you know, if we're going to operate under a principle of democratic rule, that we are ruled by those that we select. Right, and you know how we go about doing that, of course, is the question involved in this case. But that's really the big question. I mean, it involves who are we going to select as our leaders, right? And again, that's a huge question, and it's one I think that everybody sort of agrees on that we want to have democratic principles. The question is, how do you get there? But the other principle that's at stake, and it's a little bit harder to grasp for many people, and that is, what do we want our judges to do? They're unelected, right? We're talking about democracy here, but at the same time, we've got 9 unelected people sitting in review of what we're doing here. So the question is, you know, do we want judges involved with this, judges who are unelected, judges who don't have the institutional capacity in many respects to come up with the kinds of ideas, principles, theories, tests that we want? Mm-hmm. And so we're always balancing those questions out. But it's going to be particularly ripe, I think, here in this case. Because, as you said earlier, this is not something the court often does. And so we're going to hear all kinds of questions asked about, do we want courts doing this? Because they don't have the expertise, they don't have, right, you've heard the stories. So we've got those two big principles here, and the question is, who's going to control that narrative?
What about the concerns that our judiciary, a third part branch of government, is becoming increasingly politicized? When I think it was then candidate Trump said, a so-called judge.
Yeah.
Are you worried about the politicalization of our American judiciary?
I am. It's something that definitely concerns me. I think we need to have a strong, independent judiciary. I think having judges sit in review of legislation, but of disputes. I think it's immensely important for us. It's really been a rock of stability for the country over time, and we need to protect that. It's very, very important that we protect that. At the same time, I think people also have to be sympathetic, though, to the claim that judges have a certain responsibility, certain prerogatives within the position, and if they go beyond that, things get problematic. And so I don't think that comments like so-called judges are helpful, right? But I do think that it's relevant for us from time to time to ask ourselves, are our judges doing what we want them to be doing? Are they doing what we expect them to be doing? And what's constitutionally appropriate for them to be doing? So the judges have become, the process has become more politicized. I think judging has become more politicized. And there are many reasons for that. But I also think that one of them is that because judges are doing more now than they had in the past. And with that, of course, just comes extra baggage. I'm not saying one thing or the other, like they should or they shouldn't be doing it, but I do think to the extent that they're more involved than they have been in the past, they're going to be criticized more than they have been, and that's just the way it goes.
Two final questions. When the Democrats put out statements saying, we've been thrown a lifeline,
right?
In your opinion, they're overstating it, right?
To the extent that they're... To the extent that the court hasn't summarily reversed them, yeah, they've been thrown a lifeline. But I wouldn't be particularly confident right now if I were them. The signs are not pointed in the right direction. Now, again, it could be that Kennedy says, we're going to hear this case. I'm putting a stay on it.
Yep.
We're going to hear it. I'm going to reverse it, not because I don't think this is something we shouldn't be doing, but because I just don't like the test that they applied below. That's possible.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's likely. I think it's less than 50% that he does that.
If the court adopted a new precedent, wasted votes, efficiency gap, right, would that further politicize our U.S. Supreme Court, Professor?
I think what it would do is it would get the federal judiciary involved with many, many, many of these cases.
They'd have to decide every one, wouldn't they?
I think they would. I mean, to the extent that they have to now, right, I think they'd probably be a little bit more involved than they are right now with it. And we'd be right back here again. So I think whatever the Supreme Court does here in this case, it needs to be very clear, and it needs to be very forthright with what it expects and what it wants. Whether that's we don't have, it's a non-justiciable political question, we're not going to get involved, fine. Or if it's a test, fine. Whatever it does, though, it has to take pains to be very, very clear.
Thank you. Ryan Owens is a political science and law professor at the UW-Madison. The Supreme Court just acted this morning. We're very glad you came in to help us understand it.
You bet.
Thank you, Professor.
You're welcome.
Thank you.